Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Clapham Grand. Please welcome a man who has run 20 miles in the last 8 days. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much, my goodness. Hello. It's as full as it can get here at the Clapham Grand. I'd love to see you all. Thanks so much for coming to what is called, I should have opened this before I got on as always, Richard Herring's Loquacious Shits Talking Podcast. It's basically what it is all the time. Should have just called it that from the start. Though I was talking to Badil and Skinner and the Lightning Seeds. Remember that song from the 1990s? Remember that? They all got together to remember the 1990s. Remember it? They call it Rahalastapa, apparently, in this case. And said it's coming home. They said something about it coming home. The people listening to this as a podcast will know whether it's come home or not. When David Badil was on the other week, I tried to pitch to him that we should do a song that I've written the lyrics to, which are, "It's come home, it's come home. Look, there it is over there." So we'll know. If that's number one as you listen to this, you'll know that we won the football. We're all hopeful here, tragically. Welcome to the show. It's absolutely lovely to be back at the Clapham Grand for the last 2 weeks this week, and we'll be back next week as well, obviously, to do the next one. I've been training for my running. My BMI is now 29.8, which means... I'm officially not a beast. That's first thing in the morning. After breakfast, I'm a beast again. But first thing in the morning, I'm simply overweight now. I've lost 3.5 kilograms since we first did the Clapham Grand. So that's not too bad. This is fitting a little bit better than it was at the start. So that's good. I've been running. I ran eight and a half miles yesterday morning. Not bad, is it? I've got to do 13. If you want to sponsor me, I'm running a half marathon in November to raise funds for the two hospitals that... one of them cut my bollock off. I don't know why I'm raising money for them. And one of them stitched me back up again, so that they should get most of the money. Go to justgiving.com/monoball and
You can donate to that. If you're glad that I'm still alive, if you're disappointed I'm still alive, I mean, go to the List Hospital, smash up a scanner. This week I have been thinking about... I just wondered, and it's not a morbid thought, it sort of sounds like it is, but I just think it's quite interesting. Has the photo that will be on my obituary been taken yet? And it's quite... For me, some people, it's obvious whether they will be or not. Sometimes you think, well, they're definitely there. I'm not sure I've done my most successful thing. I've not done a standout thing yet. And so I can be hopeful in the third act of my life, that could be when I do something successful. Or it'll be, you know, me standing next to Stuart Lee behind him. That might be what we get. It's just quite an interesting thing, and it's quite interesting. Annika Rice actually tweeted me when I tweeted about this, and I'd said, you know, you're definitely, the picture of you will definitely be you in a jumpsuit from Treasure Hunt or Challenge Annika. Whatever you do, you could cure cancer now, you could win a Nobel Prize. And she said, it will just be my arse, it won't even be my face. And so some people you know, and some people you think, well, it's quite interesting. Be interesting. So I'm going to ask next week's guests about that, and I wonder if they've had their obituary photo. I mean, I hope Ed Gamble has. I'm hoping to kill him today. What else have I got to... I've been trying to come up with... I'm going to do at least a show about my situation this year, and maybe a podcast and maybe a book as well. So I've been trying to come up with titles for that. Well, every time I say this on Twitter, people suggest titles, and it annoys me because I'm a professional and I've thought of all the good titles, and I don't need... This year, the last week, I just said I'm going to block anyone who suggests titles, and just everyone's kept on suggesting titles. And I knew they liked me and were fans of mine, and I had to block them. It was tragic. But here, the ones I've come up with, so my two favourites are Can I Have My Ball Back? Which I quite like. And Never Mind My Bollock. That is... the first one went better out of those two. I was drifting towards the second. Right, we'll come back later for more stuff. We've got a fantastic, okay, absolutely unbelievable guest for you this week's podcast. He's probably best known for playing Ray Fay in Queen Kong. That's why we're here. A film that was never released, but that I watched on YouTube this morning. That is 90 minutes of my life I'm not fucking getting back, so I'm taking it out. Will you please welcome the amazing Robin Asquith, ladies and gentlemen? Amazing. Look at this man. Incredible.
It's an illusion, isn't it? I mean, it really is. The pills wear off at about 9 and then I disintegrate.
So, let's talk about Queen Kong. I've watched two films as a research for this. I've watched Queen Kong and I watched the first Confessions film. And I saw in Confessions I was watching your arse bumping up and down in a load of foam and thinking I've never had to do this for a guest before.
By the way, that's my obituary photograph.
Okay, I think it might...
That's it.
Well, yours has definitely been taken.
It's
yours
my arse, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, tremendous.
Yeah, I think maybe hanging out the window, that one when you're hanging out the window,
that might be
your obituary photo. Yeah, February. Your arse will be involved.
It will be, yes.
Tell us about Queen Kong, though, because it's quite an interesting...
Well, story. It was 1976, and I just won the most promising newcomer award, if you excuse the expression. I was all baffed up, and I was very pleased with myself. And so my agent said, we're going to look around and we'll see if there's something, we'll look for something really interesting for you. And in those days, if you won an award, it actually put you out of work for about a year. You just didn't work because you won an award for some strange reason. In any case, the first thing that my agent came up with, she said, this I think is a really good idea. It's called Queen Kong. And I really thought she'd lost her marbles, bless her. And so I said, what's it about? She said, well, it's a role reversal. It's a female gorilla with big breasts who falls in love with Ray Fay, as opposed to Fay Ray. And you're the only male in it, and there's dancing girls. And I said, I thought we were looking for something serious, you know, and I'd sort of was warming up my Coriolanus, if you'll excuse the expression. And This script was presented to me, and I've never read such tosh in my life. It was just unbelievable. And I really did think it was a joke. And it was the hot summer of 76. And it was shot at Shepperton Studios. And by the way, I eventually got lured into it. I've never been paid so much money in my life. And there was nothing else going on. And I thought, oh, well, why not dancing naked girls and a female gorilla with big knockers? It's going to be an interesting... at school, of course, I had imagined playing Hamlet and God knows what else. But there I was with a gorilla with big tits. And it was a fascinating summer, to be honest.
Yeah. It's an interesting film. Now, like, there's some plot holes in it. And the special effects aren't great. But, in some parts of it, it reminded me of Airplane. There were bits of it that were like Airplane.
True.
Before Airplane.
Yes.
And there's a lot of bits that weren't like Airplane.
Yes.
But also there's the sort of big... I mean, it's sort of having its cake and eating it a little bit, but it's got a sort of feminist women's lib ending where you give an impassioned speech to all the women watching about how they're being, you know,
overlooked. Well, your friend Stuart Lee has written a dissertation on it. He's actually impassioned by the whole thing and asked me to sign the book. I mean, the poor man is obviously delusional, but he thinks it's a whole sort of ahead of its time tale of feminism and the fight and everything. To me, it's about a gorilla with big tits, you know, and me dancing around with lots of naked girls and getting their phone numbers. And... you talk about the special effects. It was shot at Shepperton, and there was a special effects company called Bill Butt Richardson and Kirkland Richard, BBRK, Richardson Kirkland. And they eventually bought Shepperton Studios with Ridley Scott. And they were the huge special effects people, and they'd been employed to build this huge gorilla, a female gorilla, which had to appear in the film at some point. And there was great excitement but the day of the gorilla appearing. But they were running out of money. These Italians, it was made by Italians, were running out of money. And David Bill, one of Bill Button Richardson, said, "Robin, I've got to have a word with you." Because we all got on well. He said, "So I've got a word with you. The gorilla's not going to be all it's made out to be." And I thought, oh. He said, "Don't get too excited about the gorilla." So the day came, and there's cameras everywhere, cover cameras everywhere, girls dancing in the skirts, and it's the boomba, 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 but where you saw it this morning. And the gates open, and out comes this huge 72-foot gorilla. Well, actually, what happened was, first of all, the first assistant director couldn't speak a word of English. And he got very, very excited because there were so many cameras. And he said, "It is very, very important. We have to shit. We must shit now. Otherwise, we lose the shit." Which is the only English he managed. So he said, "Oh, are you ready to shit?" And so we were all ready to shoot. Action, all the cameras are whirring. And the gates open. And this 75-foot gorilla sort of walked out like Douglas Bader. And an arm fell off, and then another arm fell off. And we're just like, "God, this is brilliant." Dumbfounded. And then the left breast fell off. And then it all got a bit Werner Herzog. You know, more and more body bits are falling off. Eventually, it looked like John Cleese in Holy Grail. It was just an armless, limbless body sitting there. And nobody knew what to say.
And it's mainly just someone in a costume, though, in the actual film.
No, there was a Russian ballerina who was in the walked around the model village, smashing the model village up. Was the special effects. I use the term loosely. There was a Russian ballerina. In fact, in the original version, I think you've seen the picture of me tap dancing with, yeah. with a gorilla, which not many people have done. And and that was choreographed, weeks to choreograph, her in the costume and me in a sort of thong tap dancing. But it's I would love to see that footage. I don't know where it's gone.
Well, the film would never...
Stuart Lees must probably got it.
He's probably Stuart's yeah, got it.
It's in his collection.
Using it for his own amusement, I'm sure. But it's... But he never got he got kind of sued by the King Kong that was coming out, and so and the film didn't actually come out.
No, well, it did us all a favour, because yeah. Rilla Lenska, who was in it as well, we saw a preview in Wardour Street, and there was great excitement as those old preview theatres, the little curtains open, everyone going, yeah. And at the end, there was like this stunned silence, and just Rilla's voice saying to me, "If this ever gets out, darling, our careers are fucked." And we were about 24, 25 at the time. And fortunately, the next week, Dina De Laurentiis, yeah, who had produced King Kong, the one with Jeff Bridges, he put some legal suit on it, passing off, and did us all a favour. But it became cult, though, didn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's worth a look. It's on YouTube.
No, don't tell
it's
people.
It's worth a look.
Richard, it's crap. I did a show recently, a stand-up show in Darlington recently, and before all this nonsense, and I said, the guy who ran the theatre there said, "Oh, could we show Queen Kong?" I said, "No, no, please don't." And I put it up on Twitter. It's the worst film ever made. Please, he sold out like in about 10 seconds. He said, "Can you tell them it's crap again? Because we do another night."
But that's it, you know, that's there's a lot of the Room and everything. Those kind of films where they show them at the Prince Charles and
yes.
people come.
Well, you know. Funny enough, going back to Stuart again, that's his thing. He wants to show it at the Prince Charles,
right.
and then to have a chat about it. I said, "Well, there's only one thing wrong with that. I won't be there." You know?
Well, let's talk. It did make the Confessions film look like a masterpiece comparatively.
Now, careful where you go. Careful where you go. You're talking to an eclectic actor of.
Let's many. Talk about, because I want to talk about all the other stuff as well, because I know there's a lot more to you than Confessions, but that is obviously the thing that people. Remember, and it's sort of interesting going, but I was a bit too young at the time to be watching them when they first came out, but it was that kind of, even as a kid, it was like this legendary thing, but it speaks a lot of where Britain was, right, at the time, because this was like a brand new thing to have this much sort of nudity in something, right? And to,
Yeah, well, for me, as an actor, but by 1974, I'd had a we'll maybe talk about that later, but I'd had a good backlog of work. You know, I'd worked with yeah. Zaffirelli, Pasolini, Lindsay Anderson, Pete Walker. I'd done a bit, being in a film in Hollywood to pay the title. You know, I'd done quite a substantial body of work before 1974.
Yeah.
And I remember being presented with the script of Confessions of a Window Cleaner in 1973. And there was a whole load of us, Dennis Waterman, Richard Beckinsale, Richard O'Sullivan, Nicky Henson, and we were all scratching our head because we thought, you know, what is this crap? You know, what is it? Because and we all thought, turning the page, what is this shagging? What is this about? You know, it is crap. And everybody turned it down, including me. And it went from being an independent film, and by then I'd done quite a few independent films with people like Peter Walker and Richard Gordon, Horror Hospital, and films like that. Yeah. And the film started to grow. It moved to Michael Klinger, and then from Michael Klinger, it was picked up by Columbia. There was a guy called David Beagleman who was like the head of all Columbia in space. No, all Columbia in the States. Who he greenlit it. It was an American greenlit it, said, you know, this film's got to be made. But it completely reconstructed the whole thing. So the script came back to me. It wasn't just about shagging. It had become like he'd fallen in love with the middle-class policeman.
Yeah.
There was a bit more structure than just a bloke wandering around shagging. Lindsay Anderson said it was cult in Poland. He said right. he said it was a working man's film. You know, yeah. they bowed down to it. So yes, it was a surprise, but it was more of a surprise to any of us Before we came on, we were talking about George Layton, the actor George Layton. And I remember George saying, you know, Robin, I think you should do this. I think you you could do this. Yeah. I said, well, you know, but why? He said, no, because... You won't be sort of going. You'll be going. Oh, and that's. I think that's how you're going to make. I think you. So he influenced me.
Yeah.
In the fact that it could be made funny.
Well, it is. It's a comedy rather than. You know. What's interesting is that. I don't know. It's a very innocent film in a lot of ways. In that Timmy Lee is a very innocent character, and he sort of starts as a virgin and.
And it gets worse. He's sexually inept, and through the contrivance of his job and the jobs in the later films, maybe a little bit too much of contrivance. He was put in a situation where there would be a single housewife who would engage him in a sexual activity that he was just. Not up to the job, really, and therefore was the comedy. And the alpha male, of course, was played by Anthony Booth, and so you had that lovely great bit of crumpet and all that. You had that sort of, and you had me as the sort of beta, sitting back and going, I don't know, and being presented with it. There was some comedy value, and yes, it was completely. New to suddenly walk around. Don't forget, there was no videos. There was no. There was no black and white telly. Really, yeah. You know, it was. There was not much going on. So, if a film was successful, people used to go to it and queue around the block. And the only way people went to see these films. Was because people would go back to the workplace and say, you've got to see, that's a real laugh. So it was females and males and couples were queuing up. And it warmed your heart, to be honest, except on one occasion outside the Shepherd's Bush Odeon, there was my Mini Cooper broke down. And I thought, oh, Jesus Christ. And I flagged down a taxi. I said, can you give me a lift? I said, I haven't got any money on me. He said, I can't just bought. You've got no money. I said, no. If you've got any identification. And there it had Robin Asquith in Confessions of a Window Cleaner and a queue rat round the block. And he went, in your fucking dreams, and drove off.
And I guess the women in... It's I mean, it sort of talks to the innocence of the... It's exactly that. And now in this... society we live where hardcore pornography is, you know, readily available to everyone. If there was any sort of titillation in it, it's literally titillation. There's a little bit of tit shown.
Well,
in.
Yes, but it yes, and it didn't attract the Mary Whitehouse Brigade.
Right.
Strangely enough, the BBC there was a program called Face to Face, and they thought, it'd be a great idea to put Robin Asquith. Up against Mary Whitehouse, and all we did was sit there agreeing about things. It was—I don't think it was ever aired.
Right.
You know, we weren't arguing about anything, and it was. But the thing was, it was nudity,
yeah.
and a lot of full frontal and simulated sex, and that really hadn't been seen on a mass scale. You know, you couldn't take your girlfriend out and go and get away with that. They'd be sniggering along, and then suddenly there's. It's all going on.
But it sort of saved the British film industry as well, right? Because the British...
Don't like that, do they?
No.
And Films and Filming certainly didn't like it at the time. It did. It very much did. And friends of mine, like Matthew Sweet, who's a film historian, who's become a close friend, I think in his book, Shepherd and Babylon, actually accused the confession films. He said the only reason people... stay to watch a confession film was it was cold and they were so bored and depressed they couldn't get out of their seats. Well, of course, that's nonsense because there had to be more people to come and fill the seats, and there's only way that would happen by telling people. So he's retracted all that now. So historically, they were a very, very important part of the industry. And,
yeah.
And at one point, I'm sure you were going to lead on to this, we propped up Star Wars.
Yeah.
I
was about to go on to that. Although the last thing if you watch it, and watching it again with that distance now, it doesn't feel... Like a lot of things you watch from the 70s, and there's a lot of stuff in there that you wouldn't want. And there's some, there is a bit of stuff in there in the confession, something that wouldn't fly now. But a lot of it still is okay. And I think the women in it are very much empowered. And so the women are making their own choices. It's about the women.
Including some of the actresses, yeah. You know. And they go on social media now, people like Judy Matheson and people like that. When somebody has a go at them, says, no, hang on, I was in that. You know, I'm a feminist. And, yeah. You know, even people like Samira Ahmed, you know, they actually defend the whole ethos of those films as actually being a bit pro-feminist. You know, they were not quite what they seem.
No, I think there's...
In fact, I don't think I ever went four in my life. And all you see on Twitter every now, Robin Askwith, four. I never gone four, ever.
But you've gone four now.
So I've gone now four now. I've gone four
they can,
times.
They can take so, that out as a gif, and then it's four. Just you. Saying,
yeah.
Got to think about it. Well, no, it's on YouTube for free as well, the first one. So you can watch that for free. I'm not going to pay for any of these. but you did, like, you were Let's Go to Star Wars, because you were filming at the same time as Star Wars.
Sorry, I led you
no,
into...
No, but I was going to go on to, because it's fascinating. So you, that the idea of those two films filming next to each other...
Well, it was two. It was Confessions of a Driving Instructor, and then we thought we'd up our game, and we did Leslie Thomas's book, Stand Up Virgin Soldiers. Yeah. So we'd actually taken over Elstree Studios. So I was the king of Elstree, and Andrew Mitchell, God rest his soul, who was the general manager of Elstree at the time, used to like curse this. Bloody! But just to precursor that story, there was Dave Prowse, who was a delightful man and was always an extra on the Confessions film and everything else. Famously said to me, I said to him, "Have you got any work? You know, I've just been polite." He said, "Oh yeah, then all right. George Cukor." Who's George Cukor? I mean, George Cukor, it was George Lucas. George Cukor has offered me this film called Star Wars. And I said, well, that sounds crap. He said, no, it's very good. I said, well, what character have you been offered? And he said, well, I've been offered Chewbacca, who's a big furry monster, or a bloke in a dark black cape and a helmet. I said, here's the key. Where's it being shot? He said, Tunisia, mostly. I said, black cape. So that's how he came to play Darth Vader. This is true stuff. So I tell that before we lead on to how I got involved with the Star Wars, because we were very successful. Confessions of a Driving Instructor, that's the third one. We were going to go into Stand Up Virgin Soldiers. All the bills were being paid at the studio, but there was one film that wasn't paying their bills. It was the Star Wars. it was dying on its arse. Wasn't it? All the models were falling over and this, that, and the other. And we used to go and visit the set and snigger at what the hell was going on there. And Linda Bellingham, God rest her soul, said, oh, Asquith, he's a very good-looking chap. The leading bloke is a very good-looking chap. I'd love to meet him. I said, well, okay. So we're sitting one day, and Dave Prowse has said, I'll introduce you to him. Oh, yeah, his name's Harrison Ford. You must see he's a nice chap. So I said, well, Linda Bellingham wants to meet him. So we went over, and it was Harrison Ford and Mark Hamill flicking through there, learning their lines. And so we went over to meet them, and Dave Prowse said, I'll let you to meet. It's a friend of mine. He's a great bloke. He's a big star. There's a Robin Esquith here. And I've said, oh, yeah, sorry, what was your name? I didn't get it. He said, Harrison Ford. I said, well, you're going to have to change that, mate. It's two surnames. You're not going to get anywhere. And I didn't, 2 days later, because you think of the Han Solo outfit, which was identical to the waiters in the Elstree studio. So he didn't love me anymore when he walked past. I said, where is the wine menu? For goodness sake, please, where are you going? He just thought I was an arsehole, really.
It's so amazing to think of Linda Bellingham and Harrison Ford's worlds colliding in that way.
Exactly. Well, they didn't, actually, of course. No, they didn't. Because... But no, he's a very good-looking bloke, and we visited the set many, many times for her to gloat and watch this ridiculous nonsense. And what was funny about that, all the robot, they all argued. They all hated each other, and their heads were falling off. And then, of course, in the middle of this, you got Dave Prowse saying, "Oh, please let me take this helmet off, please. I want to have a kip a roll."
Well, you know, that's show business, isn't it? You just don't know. You don't know what's going to be the big hit. I don't know. But both films still remembered. Maybe not. I mean, Confessions maybe not made as much money as Star Wars. But it did it more at the time.
Well, they got the America. The thing Confessions never got was America. Basically, America had Mary Tyler Moore and Deep Throat. we sort of came in the middle of it, so it didn't happen, really.
No.
But not that I care.
It's a very British. But you know, as you're saying,
Benny Hill.
You're saying your book about Benny Hill that it was the one who kind of managed to take that.
Yeah, that was about 5 years later. Yeah.
But you know, it's fascinating.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Now, look, let's talk about your childhood a little bit, because I think that sort of does, before we go into your more serious roles and that came before and after Confessions, because I think it does sort of inform, and people wouldn't be necessarily aware of this. So as a boy, was it about 8 years old, was it, when you got...
Four,
so you're very young when you contracted polio.
Yeah.
And were quite badly disabled by polio.
Yeah, well, I think it's depicted very well in the Ian Drury biopic, Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll, the whole polio thing. And if anyone's got the time, watch that film. There's a documentary about an hour and a half long about the two American scientists battling over the vaccination. It's a fantastic story. But polio was around. I mean, obviously, this is quite a sort of apt story for now, but... Polio was around, and I was very unlucky to have it. And it was, you know, it was nothing to do with class. Whatever you were put into these homes, because no one was quite sure how you caught it, what it was. They certainly weren't going to lock down. You know, there was things weren't treated. There was no social media, but there was polio, and I was put in one of these homes. And then it got worse. Then I was put in an iron lung for about 4 months. Right. And your head's just sticking out. And I think when you've been through something like that, you just are pretty grateful that any day after that gets better, really.
Yeah.
It was an odd time. But the sort of things you remember are the extraordinary bravery of, the nurses. I mean, because no one would come and see you. There was, windows at the back where people would come and check on you, but they weren't allowed in because they didn't know what was going on.
Right.
But there were people that nursed you, and there were priests and people would come in, risking everything to sort of touch you, and they burnt all your toys and burnt everything. It was a pretty horrendous time. But as a kid, you've got no idea of anything else. You maybe think everyone else is like this.
Sure.
And then you're put in, as in the Ian Drury thing, you're put in a sort of home. And once again, you're not allowed to be seen. And it was distressing my parents because they thought he should see his parents. So my grandfather came up with this great idea. This sounds all wrong now, but you've got to remember this is 1955. They all blacked up. So then my family, and this is before Windrush or anything, yeah. I suddenly was aware of my family standing behind a glass window, blacked up.
Right.
But first of all, it didn't mean anything to me in anything. There was my family blacked up, which is even more distressing. What's happened to them? I was very, very fortunate, as was Ian Drury in a way. You know, most people died and that was the end of it, or were left with the unbelievable bits falling off them.
Yeah.
And my mother said, look, I'm going to give you threepence. Eventually, when I got out of the hospital, about 9 months, and got out of the home, and you got out of the home, they said to your parents, and we were a very good middle-class family. We weren't short of anything. They said, you do not treat this boy with any faith. You're stricter with him than you are the children. For some reason, that's what they thought you had to do. But my mother, and I was in a wheelchair and stuff, and my mother said, I'll give you threepence. Because I was brought up in Southport in Lancashire, you go up to the slipper baths, the saltwater baths, and so I was given threepence, and every day my leg got stronger. So I was pretty lucky through swimming.
Yeah.
So I was very, very lucky indeed.
Yeah. And so I mean that obviously must have. So like when you you got fitter and you were able to walk again, and it must have been sort of mind blowing, and it must have informed the kind of person you became.
Well, yes, I became very obviously addicted to sport, and was lucky enough to go to very sporty schools,
yeah.
And played sport somehow. I had a dodge. For cricket, people would notice that I had a slight gait running to the boundary. And in those days, you know, we had nicknames, and mine was Spaz. You know, that was my nickname. How well would that go down today? But I didn't mind. You sort of wore it with pride, and it did make you try harder. And also, I never talked about polio until about 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
And it was because, once again, we were talking about him earlier, it was George Layton, who we were having a chat on stage at the Cinema Museum. And he asked me, Mishwa, you're going to ask me, what on earth is it like to take your clothes off in front of a camera crew, and why do you do it with such ease? And I did it in If, the first film I was ever in. There's a shower scene.
Yeah.
And I said, do you know what I think it is, George? I said, I think it's when you've been naked as a child and people photograph your body, slightly deformed, and you've given this chance that it's all sorting itself out. You don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You don't. I'm naked. Bollocks to it. If you know, literally.
Don't mention bollocks.
I know. It's your show. I'm feeding.
But yeah, I mean, is that, and it must have been just so great to feel, you know, that you were seen as a sex symbol and that people wanted to see you naked. That must have been.
Yeah, but I don't think I ever took my clothes off and went, look at this.
Yeah.
You know, it was. I must say I'm amazed that when I watch something like Horror Hospital and I'm running through fields being chased by leather-clad bikers and there's somewhere there's a six-pack. And I think, first of all, there was no gyms then. How did that happen? But at no point did I think, go whoopee. It was more the fact that I could move. You know, I was just pleased. I never. It was a sort of gay, the early gay thing of the early 70s. That I was more aware that my body was quite cool because, you know, I was pursued by directors,
right,
mostly Italian. it was only then that I realised, oh, you know, I'm quite attractive here.
Yeah.
But it didn't really mean that much.
And also, from you were quite a naughty boy at school.
Yes.
So, there's stories in the autobiography is very much worth reading. I hope you'll write the second one, as you promised at the end of the first one, but we haven't seen it yet. But you talk about getting your headmaster's car put on the chapel roof by,
well, yes,
by a
I
man
went,
in a crane. Is that for real?
Yeah, well, I went to a merchant tailor's school, which was a very good public school. I was Orley Farm first prep school, with Anthony Horowitz and who every time I mention it on Twitter or Leaf Army, he says, oh, he'll put a message. He says, I've got to go straight back to the psychiatrist. You know, he had a terrible time. Right. And Simon McCorkendale people. And then I went to Merchant Taylor's, and it was just that time, Richard. It was the 60s, and the music, and do you know what it was? It was as simple as this. National service got stopped.
Right.
And we thought, great. We're not going to have to fight. We're not have to fight a war.
Yeah.
You know, and every generation before us had fought a war. You know, the Second World War, First World War, Boer War, Crimea War, whatever. It all went back to wars, and we did not want to fight a war. And then this whole music thing came through. The peace and love thing came through. And I was in a public school, and I had imagination, and I was quite popular. And I thought, I'm just going to have a ball. And I was passing exams all right somehow. Yeah. So, and I was quite good at sport. So I was having a great time, but it was not popular with the masters, particularly the headmaster. I got a friend of mine, a wealthy friend of mine, whose father owned Crane Frohauf or whatever those, whatever, Massey Ferguson, one of those. And we paid one of his workmen to bring a crane and remove on the Sunday the headmaster's Austin 1100 and put it on the chapel. So he came out, apparently, allegedly, he came out and just opened the door and saw his car and went, Asquith. Which I thought was unfair, you know. It was correct, but it was slightly unfair. And eventually I was just coming up to A levels, and I was going mad. You know, yeah. I was in a band. I just replaced Peter Gabriel as a drummer because he was useless in a band. So my drumming career looked quite thing, and it was very good for girls. I joined the Young Communist Party, which wasn't very popular at public school either, but it was great for girls to stand outside the top rank Watford, issuing out copies of Young Socialist, until our friend's father picked us up in the Jag. You know, it was it's all a bit of a giveaway. Nothing's changed. In the end, this headmaster just he made a speech at an assembly about the Dolce Vita life that Robin Asquith was leading, and it's not to be commended at all. And I'm sitting there, and people are thinking, God, this sounds great. You know, he made an error there. And so my next move was to raid the armory, because it was rag week. And we held up in a post office and took all the commemorative stamps. I gave them back, of course. Eventually he did expel me. He let me back take my A-levels. I talking of obituaries, I'm one of the only people, I think, that are mentioned in the headmaster's obituary. In his Sunday Times obituary, this is one of his great regrets, is expelling me. Robin Asquith, he was a man of high spirits and nothing more, which was a nice...
That is nice, but you did put his car on a roof and hold up a post office. I mean, I know the 60s and 70s were liberal, but...
But hang on, there's nothing salacious about that. There was nothing political.
There's nothing political.
It was quite inventive.
Yeah, Diz is very inventive.
Yeah. And it's an Austin 1100, for fuck's sake.
But yeah, do you feel that you lived at this sort of golden time, that you had your teenage years at that time and then going into the 70s and becoming this very successful actor?
Yes, I do.
Fancy Free and Single, just when the pill had come out and everyone and sexual liberation.
Yeah, no, I had a fantastic time. I really did. The only thing, and I think where you and Stuart and stuff were, I'm not going to say lucky, but had something that we didn't have, is we didn't have any stand-up. Even though I was an actor, I would be... The guy used to hand the... I've never told him, but I used to hand the Young Socialist out. Yeah. His next-door neighbour was Barry Cryer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we used to... Barry was terrific, you know, very encouraging, being a young actor, and he was always very encouraging. And even then I would be telling some story about something in his front room, and he said, you should be a comedian. But I didn't want to be a comedian. I did not want to be a comedian. And I was about 19 a bit later on, so I'm starting to work... And he said, this is the sort of bloke you should be like. And he brought in a 17-year-old Jim Davidson. Right. And at that point, I thought, no, that's just exactly who I don't want to be fucking like, Barry. And so when your era came along, it kicked off a bit earlier with Billy Connolly, you know, the Stream of Consciousness. That is the only thing I really missed out on.
Sure, but you're doing that. So you're doing it now. Well, you're doing these one-man shows. That's...
Tickets available the 20th.
Yeah, it's such a rich life. And there's a lot of stories you've got about... We don't have time to get onto all of them. I'll just check. We have got some time. But I do want to talk about lots of different things.
I've got till
Thursday. Yeah, we can keep going. But, you know, you've worked with everyone, and what is interesting, I think certainly through that, reading the book, you're meeting Al Pacino, you're meeting Peter Cook, you're meeting Pamela Stevenson. It's like a very, you know, broad range of different kinds of people that you work with. You know, there's Harrison Ford, you're meeting all these different people in these different circumstances. And so you've got all these incredible stories of, you know, and you did all the partying and you did all the... You know, enjoying every aspect of that 70s life and the sex and drugs and rock and roll. You were with all the pop stars, you were with all the actresses, there was drugs. You'd hung out with Oliver Reed and survived.
Yeah, a few nights with Oliver Reed. Well, the famous one was I had a tiny part in a film called Nicholas and Alexandra.
Yeah.
And I was staying at the Madrid Hilton there was a sequence in it where I have to run through sunflower fields. It's about 100 miles north of Madrid. They were filming it. But the sunflowers hadn't turned round at the right speed. So they were waiting for the sunflowers to turn before they could do these shots with me, with my girlfriend. And we rolled around what we had to do in this film. So it was crazy. A multi-million dollar... I'm just sitting in the Madrid Hilton in the bar. And then Oliver Reed, who wasn't even in the film, turned up and took quite a liking to me. And I'm 19. I've got nothing to do. I'm waiting for these flaming sunflowers to turn around, which he thought was very amusing. And we used to drink every night. And there was a huge fish tank behind the bar. And one night there's some Americans driving him mad. And he just went... He said, just keep these Americans talking, Asquith, old chap, I'll be back. Right, so I kept him talking, the fish tank's here, and I'm talking to these Americans, and suddenly they went, ah, gee, oh my God! And in the fish tank was Oliver Reed naked, attacking a carp, and they ran out, you know, you know, evenings like that, just terrific, you know.
But when there was so much money in the movies and, you know, they could... I mean, I suppose there still is in the big, big blockbusters, but it just seemed like there was endless money going on and that they could keep you waiting for months.
Well, yes, there were two types of films. There was those type of films, and then, you know, a year later, I'd be making a film like Cool It Carol with having a leading part in an independent film. A very underrated film, in my opinion. And you're filming six pages a day.
Yeah.
It's a completely... And you're working all sorts of hours. And then you're right. And then suddenly I'd be flown off somewhere to be in another small part in another big budget film. And you're sitting... I remember once sitting by a swimming pool for 2 weeks getting a suntan, and the second assistant of the second assistant of the second assistant said, we're going to need you tomorrow. And I genuinely looked disappointed because I thought, well, I'm not tanned down here. But, you know, I've got another week here.
Reading the book, it just seems like you were working constantly. Your year was incredibly... You were doing TV, you were doing films, and you were working with Pasolini and having to wee off balconies and...
My thing was just work. And I had an agent, a great lady called Hazel Malone, who had Richard O'Sullivan, Jeremy Bullock, Malcolm McDowell, Susan George, Judy Geeson. You know, she had a good crop of people. And she'd keep you and encourage you to keep working, not to sit around and wait for the big one to come along. So, yeah, I would do an episode of Please Sir, and then I'd fly off to Hollywood and play a lead in a musical, ice skating and dancing. You know, all actors lie about everything, don't they, when they go for an audition. Can you sing? Yeah. Can you dance? Yeah. Can you ice skate? Yes. So I could do none, but I could by the time it finished. So But my work ethic was just to keep working.
Yeah.
And whatever precise part it was.
But you were working. So you worked with Pasolini. You worked with Lindsay Anderson. You worked in these films that have gone on to be classic films, as quite a serious actor in some of them. And so, do you feel? I mean, obviously, you had that decision to make about going to Confessions, and you didn't know whether what that would lead to. You could have no idea it would become as successful as it did.
No idea.
When you look back, it's an impossible thing to decide.
Impossible.
But do you look back and think you wish you'd not done that and gone down the route of being a more serious actor, or do you think that would?
Well, it's interesting. The only way. Because it is an impossible question, because it's there and it's happened. And it's very strange, like I do my one-man show and I look at the audience and there's people at 25. That's a bit like me at 25 going to see Douglas Fairbanks Sr., you know.
Yeah.
But Robert Lindsay was a good friend of mine and still is a good friend of mine. And I remember at the height of Citizen Smith, yeah. saying... Yeah. I shouldn't get a laugh. Just made a mistake. He swerved away. He went off to the Royal Exchange, Manchester,
yeah.
and did Hamlet and stayed there for many, many years, taking his career in a completely different direction. And I remember staying with him. I went to see him in something up there. I think it was Three Musketeers, which he did with Derek Griffiths and Trevor Peacock. Fantastic production. And he said, you know, we made our choice. I was doing Who Goes Bear at the Empire, Liverpool, and he was doing the Three Musketeers at the Royal Exchange. You know, we made our choice.
But you sort of make a choice and it's not... But you don't know where it's going to lead.
No.
So you could easily have done Confessions and it could have been... You know, the fact it's remembered all these years later is incredible. And you couldn't predict that it would be... You know, obviously that is then going to affect the roles that you're offered in the future. But you have also... You know, you have gone on and done loads of different aspects of acting since then. And I kind of think, you know... You're a very funny actor, and you're a very funny person. So I think you would have gone. I think you would have probably gravitated towards comedy in any case.
I think you're right. And I've to move into the present, if I'm allowed to. You saying that is I've just and you'll see it. I have no idea how successful anything's going to be, and I really hope it is. Sally Lindsay sort of virtually taught me into this new series, Madame Blanc, which we've just finished shooting. For Channel 5 with Steve Edge, Sue Holderness, Sally Lindsay, and me. And it's a drama series, sort of Montalbano meets Lovejoy, if you like, set in France. And I had to be talked into doing it by Sally because it is quite a serious part.
Sure.
with a sort of eccentric trait which could be exploited. I'm very lucky at the age I am now to suddenly someone see that and go, yeah, you can do that. You don't, because I must say I've got a bit fed up of tripping over the furniture and farce and whatever, as much as I enjoyed that.
But, you know, I think you really made the most of it. You obviously enjoyed yourself at the time when you were doing it. You did, like, live shows with the confession stuff, which you basically created a comic persona and ad-libbed around a script that someone else had written that wasn't...
Well, fine. Yeah, what that was at the end of the confessions, when everyone made a conscious decision, right, that's the end, Confessions of a Holiday Camp, we're going to do no more. And they were still making money. When everybody said they were making money and there was a decision to make no more, mainly by Greg Smith and me. And... I was suddenly, having had all that success with all the films, I'd made about 30 films by then,
yeah.
And for all sorts of different directors and producers and stuff, and so I had to make a decision, what the hell was I going to do? So what I did, I went up to Columbia's offices in Wardour Street, got a map of the world, and I said, where are these films successful? And so I went, right, and I got a script that somebody else wrote, correct, and it was so awful that the further Confessions of Window Cleaner. I sort of did a Gary Shandling before Gary Shandling did it. I came out to the audience and said, look, I'm really sorry about this show. It is dreadful. There's nudity and you're going to hate it. Some of the cast are crap. I said, it's all we could get. And when there's nudity, look away. It's offensive. It's all this. And then I would step into the play.
Yeah.
And all these dreadful things would happen. And the audience, it just packed out all around the world. So there was 5 years of that.
Yeah.
Which was virtually stand-up, sort of.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you talk about in the book about being the thing, you know, going to Rhodesia and the theatre being sort of bombed as you were as you were performing. Not because they didn't like the show.
Well, in one case, we're right in the middle of the war, and somebody said, you can't go to Rhodesia now. It's in the middle of the war. I said, that's the time to go. That's the time to go. And the great thing about Rhodesia is we had our crew were both Matabele and Shona. We had both tribes working for us, and they all got on,
right.
You know, because they loved the theatre. You know, then outside, they're shooting each other. But in the theatre, they... there was a guy, talking about this to a friend last night, about I had a guy used to come up and bring me a cup of tea in the interval and everything. And he was a lovely old man, and the many years I went to Rhodesia, his name was Tifa. And at the end, when it obviously became, you just couldn't go back anymore, and he said, I'm going to say goodbye now, my boss, I'll never see you again. I said, of course you wish. No. It's bad. So I said, can I ask you one question? I said, I've always wanted to know, why are you called Tifa? Expecting to hear some sort of embellished tribal saga. And he said, it is because I make tea for you. Which I thought was really sweet. No, I was very lucky. I would, you know, traveled all around the world and was arrested in South Africa.
Yeah.
I was arrested for indecency, yes, mercifully, and escorted to the airport. And at the airport, I was handcuffed, taken out at Joburg, at the Jens Smits Airport. Coming the other way was Gareth Hunt, who was being feted and photographed as I'm being handcuffed, taken out. I think he was wondering, is this what happens to all English actors?
It could be. And so in the book, at the end, you do talk about getting on a flight somewhere and a guy saying to you, I had my first wank over you. How does it feel about knowing that a lot of men in the 1970s...
No, wait a minute. The point about that story is it was first class.
Right.
And it was between London and Singapore. I was going out to Australia. It was first class seats. And we were sitting there. And this guy, he was a philosopher. He was the... Doctor of Philosophy, he taught at Swansea University,
right.
And he was a highly academic man. He's talking about this and that and stuff. I had no idea what he was talking about, but pretended to. And we're going on, and I hadn't talked about me at all. I just assumed he just thought I was somebody, I don't know what he thought I was. And I've sat there. Any case, as he's leaving the aircraft, that's exactly what he said. By the way, he said, I'd just like you to know, you were my first wank. I thought, Jesus,
as long as it wasn't during the flight.
It's a 14-hour flight.
But how does it feel to know? I mean, it sort of feels, again, looking at it from a 21st century perspective, it sort of feels ridiculous that anyone could use Confessions of Window Cleaner as pornography because it seems so tame. But then I remember what I used to use as pornography in the 1970s and 80s. Going, okay. I would have quite liked this, but you know, to know that's
you got me.
You're the bum. You're the bum getting in the way of a lot of horny young men's fantasies.
Yes. Well, I don't know. Maybe he was just gay.
It could be. True,
Could. Maybe I was just his first wank.
Yeah, it's true.
Maybe he came out of the closet. You know, it's. It's. But I've never thought of it like that. I never thought of it as salacious or anything. It was just a job and trying to... I know it sounds stupid, but trying to make people laugh, you know, within those confines. But that was the point. That's why the confession films, in my mind, came to an end, was I had Shagger's block. There was nowhere I could go anywhere. You know, there was every possible position, situation. It'd been done. There was no more jokes about it. I would, I would have, I was going to say I had to lose a testicle, but, I mean, but you know, there was nowhere to go with it. And also, I was sick to death of shagging.
Yeah. Well, it's difficult to film that. I mean, I've talked to other people about very limited. It's difficult to be filmed, you know, simulating or even...
Hundreds of times.
Yeah, surrounded by a big crew of... More men coming in to see the naked women, I'm guessing.
It always makes me laugh when people say, oh, it must have been great, all those girls, blimey, it must have been terrific, wouldn't it? But it's 8 o'clock in the morning, bright lights, so you can see everyone's pimples and spots, and you've got lines, you've got to engage with a woman like a Linda Bellingham or Pamela Stevenson, whoever you're with, Jill Gascoigne, you know, some good Liz Fraser. There's some good people out there. Yeah. But it was a film. People wanted to be in films. So it was quite nerve-wracking. And also, as the leading actor, I had to relax them a little bit. Because they were very, very nervous.
Sure.
And, you know, you're in a bath with Liz Fraser, and I suddenly came out with this idea, oh, wouldn't it be great, because we're shagging away in a bath. I said, I've got this idea to the director. Can we pretend there's a duck underneath her arse? So, just to try and make it different. So, and then lay on the track. And they went, oh, that's brilliant. Liz, is that all right? Oh, yeah, great idea. You know, it's you know, is this the sort of conversation Alec Guinness had with Jack Hawkins? Most probably, actually, but that's another story. And so they got this toy duck, and we improvised around it. So I don't know where I was going with that.
Well, it's an incredible thing, and it, you know, and you're right that all the actors, there's a lot of big actors in those films. There's a lot of
I know where I was going with it. In the end, you run out of ideas.
Yeah.
And you have everybody watching. You're doing, and of course, arts became so popular. They wanted to sell to all the different regions, so that we had to make an A version, which was naked, a B version, which was the girls with their tops off. And their bottoms on, and I was naked. Then there was a C version, which we were shagging in underwear. And I asked, one day I got so fed up with all this, and also it was rubbing me, you know. And I said, but who's this for? They said, South Africa. And I thought, we're making a whole version for South Africa of people shagging with their clothes on. That's sort of, you know, crazy.
Yeah, yeah. It was, you know, it was, but that's what I sort of think is an historical document. It's really interesting because it tells you a lot about the society, you know, that any of that stuff was sort of titillating. It sort of shows you how repressed, in a way, the country, that people must have been, or, you know, even as free love was the pervasive thing, that people were going to the cinema to see this kind of bawdy romp. There was an element of repression.
Well, I'm slightly moving away, but sort of the same point is, having just made a television series with COVID restrictions, you've got to remember that Confessions of a Window Cleaner, for instance, was made during the 3-day week.
Right.
And dustbins were piling up. And there was a huge unemployment. And the unions were strangleholding the film industry. And you'd be in the middle of a scene at 5:20... the bell, that was the end of the day.
Yeah.
It was not easy to make a film with all those results, so you're right.
Yeah.
So to make a film that then was successful, but then there was people that didn't like it. Yeah, I remember at a press junket at the Odeon Birmingham, some guy, the critic up there, he actually assaulted me. He said, bless you, he said, he said, are you taking the piss then? And actually lunged towards me and had to be pulled off me. I was secretly popular, a bit like Margaret Thatcher. You know, I never met anyone that voted for Margaret Thatcher, yet she had this enormous majority.
Sure.
At the time, I've met very few people that saw a Confessions film. But then I looked in my bank account and I thought, well, I think a few people have seen it, you know. Something's going on here.
Well, it's a really interesting look back. And I think, you know, I think from a comedy perspective, I think it holds up, and it's the heart of it is in a good place, I think. And obviously, over 40, 50 years, a lot of things change. And a lot of what we laugh at changes, but I think a lot, you know, a surprising amount of it holds up, which is really unusual with comedy, I think.
It's gone through different phases, because there was when it came out, the 70s, and then it sort of dipped away. And then, of course, VHS came along, which was most... Well, no, because you were born in 86, were you?
I was born in 67, so I was...
67, right.
So I was sorry. When VHS was coming out, I was looking at things that's similar right. to...
So that's what I meant. The 86 was round about the VHS time. So then it hit that market. Then that market died down. And then suddenly I'm getting a call from a magazine called Loaded, from James Brown or someone, saying, oh, will you do an article for my magazine Loaded? I said, what are you talking about? What's Loaded? And he said, oh, you've just rescued Channel 5. I said, have I? He said, yes. It was dying on its arse, and a woman had taken over Channel 5. I can't remember her name. She'd randomly bought the Confession films, which were the first thing that ever rated. So they had another life.
Yeah.
And then the DVDs, and now the whole sort of retro thing. Sure. And the fact that I'm still alive and can talk about
it. Well, it's good you're still alive, and you're looking absolutely amazing. I mean, you know, people might be able to work out how old you are, and you don't look that old.
Thank you.
You're still doing a lot of swimming.
I've done a lot of swimming. What? I was swimming yesterday morning. I swam 2 miles yesterday morning.
Right.
I've got a... Because I live in, as you know, in Malta, in Gozo, and there was a complete and utter lockdown earlier this year. So I do use it if I can. I got a doctor's note saying this man has had polio, and like a shark, he's got to keep moving, you know. So they let me swim in the sea, and then I bought a 1.5 mil suit and used to just swim out the harbour every day and disappear up the coast.
Well, it's incredible, Rob, and I'm glad you're still going, I'm glad you're still working, and I'm glad you're doing this new sort of stand-up element of your career, and I wish you very well with it. I'm definitely going to come see it. Ladies and gentlemen, massive round of applause, the amazing Robin Aspin, legendary.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, let's go. We'll both go. Thank you. We'll be back next week. Come back next week. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Rich Herring, and my guest, Robin Asquith. The music is by Scant Regard. Thank you very much to the Clapham Grand for having us during this wonderful tea time. Thank you also. I'm indebted to Ben Walker, my producer. I'm very indebted to Chris Evans, who does so much for me and has... And I don't want to tear up, but has just really helped my career keep going in a way that I can never truly thank him for, so I won't. I am also just thank you very much to everyone who's recommends this show and listens to this show, do keep passing on the news to other people. It's a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Head to gfsboxoffice.com/Rahulastapa to buy your series pass and your show, your tickets to individual shows. There's 50% off if you're a badger. Go to gofasterstrike.com/badges to become a monthly badger and take advantage of that offer. Thank you very much for all your hard work and your good times, my fine friends. Now, goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can, and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.